Today is Friday, May 29th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 31 to 34 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's systematic campaign against Russian oil refineries, 32 strikes in the first 5 months of the year alone, alongside Russia's deteriorating military and economic position, and Sweden's formal commitment to transfer 16 Gripen jets to Ukraine as part of a $2.7 billion support package signed in Uppsala. Let's start with the most operationally significant story in today's briefing, Ukraine's deliberate and accelerating assault on Russian oil refining capacity. According to reporting sourced through Ukrainian security and military channels, Ukraine conducted at least 7 confirmed strikes on Russian oil infrastructure during May 2026 alone. That brings the total to 32 attacks in the first 5 months of this year, a figure described as nearly equivalent to the total number of such strikes conducted throughout all of 2024. That comparison is worth sitting with for a moment. Ukraine conducted in roughly 5 months what previously took an entire year. The pace and scale represent a qualitative shift in strategy, not just an uptick in activity. The underlying logic, as described in the sourced reporting, is to attack not the front line, not the tanks and trenches, but the logistical and industrial systems that keep Russian operations alive. Russia has demonstrated resilience in rerouting its oil exports through what are known as shadow fleet tankers and through Asian markets, particularly India. Ukraine's answer to that resilience has been to go further upstream, to the refineries that process the crude in the first place. Let me take you through the 7 strikes of May in sequence, because together they tell a coherent story. On May 5th, the Ukrainian Security Service, the SBU, confirmed that a drone swarm struck the Kirishi refinery in Russia's Leningrad region. This is Russia's second-largest oil refinery. In 2024, it processed 17.5 million tons of crude oil, representing 6.6% of national refining capacity. To put that in practical terms, the facility produced roughly 2 million tons of gasoline per year, over 7 million tons of diesel, 6 million tons of fuel oil, and approximately 600,000 tons of bitumen. 3 of the facility's 4 crude distillation units were damaged, and the entire plant was shut down. NASA satellite fire detection imagery corroborated the damage. The SBU attributed the strike jointly to Ukraine's unmanned systems forces and its special operations forces. 2 days later, on May 7th, drones struck the Lukoil-owned Permnos refinery in the Perm region, approximately 1,500 kilometers east of Moscow, which is notable in itself as an illustration of the operational reach Ukraine has developed. Reuters and other outlets reported on the strike. The facility is the 7th largest Russian refinery by volume, processing over 12 million tons of oil annually, equivalent to approximately 250,000 barrels per day. It produced 2 million tons of gasoline and over 5 million tons of diesel in 2025. 3 of its primary distillation units were damaged and shut down, representing half the plant's production capacity. And critically, a 4th distillation unit had already been knocked out in a separate attack on April 30th. So by the time May 7th strike was complete, the Permnos refinery was effectively offline. On May 15th, local authorities in the Ryazan region confirmed damage to an industrial facility subsequently identified as the Rosneft-owned Ryazan oil refinery, which holds annual refining capacity of approximately 17 million tons. Specific structural damage wasn't detailed beyond confirmation of fires and explosions reported by residents. 2 days after that, on May 17th, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin publicly confirmed that drones struck the Gazprom-owned refinery in southeastern Moscow itself, suspending operations. The facility processed 11.6 million tons of crude in 2024 and produced approximately 3 million tons of gasoline, 3 million tons of diesel, and around 1.3 million tons of bitumen annually. Anonymous sources cited in the reporting stated operations would require at least several days to resume, a characterization that, the sourced reporting notes, contrasted with Sobyanin's public effort to minimize the damage. On May 20th, Ukrainian drones struck a Lukoil-owned refinery in the Nizhny Novgorod region. This facility processes approximately 17 million tons of oil per year, placing it among Russia's five largest, and it's identified as the country's second largest gasoline producer. The main crude distillation unit was damaged and halted. That single unit accounts for approximately half the total facility capacity, roughly 190,000 barrels per day. The following day, May 21st, drones struck the main crude distillation unit at the Syzran refinery in the Samara region. That unit handles 70% of the plant's total capacity. Operations were shut down, with repairs estimated at a minimum of 1 month. The refinery's usual throughput is approximately 170,000 barrels per day, and it produces 1.5 million tons of diesel annually. The seventh and final confirmed May strike came on May 25th. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine confirmed a successful strike on the Belays Petroleum Depot near Unecha in the Bryansk region, located just a few dozen kilometers from the Ukrainian border. This target is different in character from the large inland refineries. The Belays Depot can store over 40,000 tons of petroleum products, and it serves as a fuel supply point for Russian military convoys supplying frontline units in the Kursk and Belgorod areas. At least three storage tanks and a pipeline were damaged. The morning after the strike, multiple fuel price increases were observed in border regions. Simultaneous Ukrainian strikes that same day also targeted an ammunition depot in Crimea and an artillery depot in Donetsk. Building on that, the sourced reporting identifies a structural reason why this campaign is particularly effective. Russia's refining network was designed in the Soviet era around a small number of large capacity nodes rather than a distributed network of smaller facilities. That makes each refinery a high-value target. Damage one node, and you remove a significant portion of national capacity. Compounding this, Russia invested tens of billions of dollars during the 2000s and 2010s to modernize these same facilities, with Gazprom and Lukoil engaging Western engineers. That modernization deepened rather than reduced the concentration of critical capacity, making the strategic vulnerability worse, not better. From the oil campaign, we move to the broader picture of Russian military and economic deterioration, a picture assembled from multiple sources that, taken together, describe a state under serious structural strain. Beginning with casualties, NATO figures cited in the sourced reporting place Russian monthly casualties at between 20,000 and 25,000 from the start of 2026. A separate Ukrainian figure suggests at least 1,000 soldiers lost per day, extrapolating to approximately 30,000 per month. Other cited figures place the monthly toll at approximately 35,000, though without explicit institutional attribution. Total Russian casualties have been estimated in the sourced reporting at over 1.2 million, with at least 300,000 deaths. Those numbers carry their own weight, but the manpower dynamics behind them are equally telling. In November 2025, Putin signed legislation enabling year-round conscription rather than the traditional seasonal drafts, a measure the sourced reporting expects to begin reaching previously insulated urban populations in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Separately, Putin signed legislation forgiving individual debts of up to approximately $140,000 as a military enlistment inducement. When you add sign-on bonuses and salary on top of debt forgiveness, the cited analysis estimates the total cost per recruited soldier at approximately $175,000. And the target populations for recruitment have narrowed. Russian universities and indebted civilians are now the two primary pools. There's a detail in the sourced reporting that deserves particular attention. An estimated 80% of soldiers dispatched toward frontline positions do not reach the line of contact. That figure, if accurate, speaks not to battlefield losses in the conventional sense, but to attrition along the supply and movement corridors before soldiers ever engage. It raises questions about what is actually happening along those routes, and connects directly to the drone campaign we discussed earlier. On the economic side, Russia has announced expected GDP growth of only 0.4% for the current year, revised down sharply from an earlier projection of 1.3%. The government is allocating roughly 40% of the budget to war-related spending. Unemployment stands at 2.1%, which sounds healthy, but is described in the sourced reporting as indicative of labor shortage rather than economic strength. A new law permitting significantly extended working hours was passed in response to that same shortage. Higher taxes and rising inflation are cited as concurrent pressures through 2026. More alarming, a Kremlin-affiliated think tank is cited as having warned in November of last year of a risk of cascading banking defaults within a 12-month horizon. Russian government debt stands at approximately 11 trillion rubles, roughly $84 billion. More than 40% of Russian clothing retail establishments are projected to declare bankruptcy in the current year. 75% of Russian companies anticipate layoffs. And in perhaps the most striking political signal in the economic data, Gennady Zyuganov, head of the Communist Party faction in Russia's State Duma, is quoted as having stated approximately 3 weeks before the sourced recording that Russia is on a path to repeat 1917. Russian banks are facing liquidity shortfalls because the government has taken loans from those institutions without consistent repayment. And in what the sourced reporting presents as an illustration of how broadly the security situation inside Russia has deteriorated, Sberbank, the Bank of Russia, and the Russian Cash Collection Association have been authorized by government decree to carry arms, specifically to address drone threats. The government has also concentrated air defense resources around leadership assets. Moscow as a whole has 68 air defense systems. A Putin-associated residence in Valdai reportedly has 26, though Putin is said not to have visited that site in over 9 months. On energy revenue, there is a cross-cutting dynamic that partially offsets the economic pressure. President Trump's confrontation with Iran, described in the sourced reporting as leading to a blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, prompted the United States to lift some sanctions on Russian oil sales to India. This has added more than $100 million per day to Putin's tax revenues. It is a significant counterweight, and it illustrates the complexity of applying sustained economic pressure on Russia when geopolitical events elsewhere can quickly undermine the architecture of that pressure. On the question of political stability at the top, The Guardian, citing multiple people in the orbit of Russian leadership, reported Putin as increasingly isolated and surrounded by a disillusioned elite. A European intelligence report shared with several outlets in early May 2026 claimed security measures around Putin had been significantly tightened since March over fears of a plot or coup attempt, and identified former Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu as a potential threat. The Kremlin responded by releasing video of Putin visiting his former schoolteacher in central Moscow and by arresting several officials described as close to Shoigu. Among those mentioned in the analytical discussion as potential successors, Alexei Duman, described as a former agriculture minister, appears frequently, though those characterizations are attributed to social media observation and analytical commentary rather than named institutional sources. British historian Robert Service is quoted describing Putin's invasion as a gigantic geopolitical blunder and characterizing Russian political legitimacy as historically resting on military glory rather than constitutional norms. Now to a development with longer-term implications for Ukraine's air power, the Gripen Agreement signed in Uppsala. At a ceremony held at a military base in Uppsala, Sweden, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a defense cooperation agreement covering the transfer and purchase of JAS-39 Gripen fighter jets. The remarks from both leaders provide the sourced detail here. Kristersson stated the agreement covers 16 Gripen C and D series aircraft that Sweden will transfer to Ukraine, with deliveries beginning in early 2027, pending the necessary export approvals. Ukraine will separately purchase 22 new Gripen E series aircraft, with negotiations described as complete and delivery projected by 2030. New Gripen E aircraft will enter service with the Swedish Armed Forces to replace the transferred capability, meaning Sweden is not drawing down its own operational capacity permanently. Kristersson placed Sweden's total military equipment assistance to Ukraine since the start of the conflict at 38 billion Swedish kroner. Zelensky stated the newly approved Swedish support package is valued at $2.7 billion, with more than $2 billion designated for aircraft and approximately $400 million for drone production. He additionally stated that Ukraine's Verkhovna Rada adopted on the same day an EU support package worth 90 billion euros for a two-year period, with 2.5 billion euros from that package allocated specifically for the purchase of modern Gripen aircraft. But Zelensky's remarks in Uppsala went beyond the aircraft deal. He used the occasion to describe what he characterized as the most critical current defense need: protection against Russian ballistic missiles. He stated that Europe possesses tools to counter cruise missiles, but that ballistic missile defense is substantially more difficult, and that Ukraine remains primarily reliant on the United States for that capability through Patriot systems. He disclosed that he had sent a letter earlier in the week to the U.S. President and Congress detailing Patriot missile requirements and their potential effect on the conflict. He also stated the supply of Patriot missiles has become more problematic due to what he described as the war in Iran, the same conflict that, as we noted earlier, has created complications for Western economic pressure on Russia. Zelensky called for Europe to develop its own anti-ballistic capabilities within what he referred to as the NB8 format, bringing together Ukraine, Nordic, and Baltic states, with a summit planned for June. More importantly, this underscores a recurring theme in how Ukraine's leadership is framing the war at this stage. The air and missile defense gap is as consequential as the ground situation, and the diplomatic energy being directed at closing it is significant. On the ground and at sea, two additional developments are worth noting. An Irish journalist and documentary filmmaker, cited as Kaylin Robertson, stated that Ukrainian drone strikes have effectively closed a highway running from Rostov-on-Don through occupied southern Ukrainian territory, through Mariupol and Melitopol, to Crimea and Kherson. She characterized this as the principal Russian military supply corridor for several years, and noted Russian military bloggers were openly expressing alarm. She also stated that drone units in Oleshki, a village south of the Dnipro River in Russian-occupied Kherson, had been systematically destroyed, and that resupply to those positions was no longer feasible, with Russian military bloggers raising the prospect of a Ukrainian amphibious crossing of the Dnipro River. At sea, Ukrainian unmanned surface vessels conducted pre-dawn strikes against three Russian Shadow Fleet tankers operating approximately 50 nautical miles north of the Turkish coast. The three vessels, the James II, flagged in Palau, the Valora, flagged in Sierra Leone, and the Altura, were engaged in ship-to-ship fuel transfers at the time of the attack, described as operationally anomalous. Ukrainian forces habitually target rudder posts and propeller shafts to disable rather than sink vessels, in part to limit ecological damage. The sourced analysis states that Finland has seized at least one, and possibly two, Shadow Fleet vessels, and that a French naval vessel seized one in the Bay of Biscay. One vessel, identified as the Ursus, is reported to have sunk in the Strait of Gibraltar, with one fatality cited. The cited analyst assesses that the total number of Russian vessels struck or disabled by Ukraine is at least 20% higher than publicly acknowledged figures. A figure identified as Robert Madar, described as a Ukrainian drone program figure, is quoted as stating that Ukrainian forces have a substantial list of targets inside Russia prepared for future strikes, and that approximately 500 targets within Belarus have been identified for strikes in the event Belarus enters the conflict, framed explicitly as a deterrent message to Lukashenko. Ukraine is currently deploying approximately 10,000 drones per day, with projections of approximately 20,000 per day by July and August, and is intercepting approximately 90% of Russian Shahed variant drone strikes. Pulling back to the broader European picture, the security architecture of the continent is undergoing accelerated reconfiguration. NATO's expansion to include Finland and Sweden has, as sourced reporting notes, effectively doubled NATO's land border with Russia. European defense spending has increased markedly, with multiple countries now meeting NATO's 2% of GDP requirement. Germany has committed to 3.5% of GDP, including collaborative and infrastructure efforts, a threshold that represents a significant departure from Germany's post-Cold War strategic posture. On the question of pro-Russian influence inside European institutions, Robertson stated she had recently attended the European Parliament and described the ongoing circulation of pro-Russian narratives among elected representatives. She identified former Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban as having leaked European defense intelligence to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and noted he was ultimately removed by his own electorate rather than through any EU institutional action, with no formal EU repercussions for those actions. She also described a Cypriot MEP, referred to as Fidesz, as having publicly stated that Ukrainian children abducted by Russia were happier there, and as having voted against motions for their return. Robertson additionally described an investigation into Irish involvement in sanctions evasion and the supply of raw materials to Russia, including interviews with six Irish MEPs who had not signed a letter supporting sanctions on aluminum exports. She also observed former German Chancellor Angela Merkel receive an award at the European Parliament and noted that Merkel had in recent weeks signaled interest in participating as a peace negotiator, a development Robertson characterized as problematic given Merkel's central role in building European energy dependence on Russia over the preceding two decades. On the nuclear front, Robertson stated that Russian forces are launching explosive-carrying drones from the rooftops of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant towards civilian targets in the Ukrainian city of Nikopol. She stated the plant's backup generators maintaining reactor cooling have failed 15 times, with the 15th failure occurring on the 40th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster. She stated the plant contains 10 times more radiation than Chernobyl and is twice its size, and that a failure could contaminate the Dnipro River, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean. The briefing notes that the IAEA is referenced obliquely as having assessed no significant problem existed, a characterization Robertson disputed. No independent scientific assessment of Robertson's technical claims regarding radiation dispersal is included in the source material, and that caveat belongs on the record. What is not in dispute is the convergence of risk factors, the cooling generator failures, the use of the plant as a launch platform, and the absence of any clear mechanism for restoring the facility to a neutral status. From the operational to the institutional, the Foreign Affairs Podcast published an interview on May 26 with Thant Mayant Yu, a historian, former UN official, and author of the essay, The Crumbling Pillars of Global Peace. His analysis offers the most systematic framework among today's sourced material for understanding the institutional context of everything we've covered. Mayant Yu draws a distinction that is analytically important. He separates the post-Cold War liberal international order, roughly 30 years of U.S. unipolar supremacy, from a deeper architecture dating to the 1940s and 50s. That deeper system, he argues, is what has underpinned more than 80 years without total war or war between great powers. His central claim is that the more serious rupture in the current period is to that deeper, older system, not merely to the post-Cold War liberal order. He attributes the current retreat from multilateralism in part to the United States, stepping away from institutions and alliances. On the UN's role, Mayant Yu traces three phases. The first, from the late 1950s through the late 1980s, centered on the Secretary General as mediator-in-chief in interstate conflicts. He points to Dag Hammarskjöld's role during the 1956 Suez Crisis and to Secretary General Pérez de Cuellar's peace processes in the Iran-Iraq War, Southern Africa, Central America, and Cambodia during the 1980s. Building on that, a second phase from the 1990s onward saw the UN retooled toward civil war peacekeeping, development aid, and human rights promotion, moving away from interstate mediation under U.S.-led unipolarity. His assessment is that this transition left the institution poorly configured for the current return of interstate conflict, which is precisely the moment it's being asked to respond. asked directly what Secretary General Guterres should have done differently ahead of Russia's 2022 invasion, Mayant Yu stated he could have traveled to Moscow, Kyiv, and Washington, engaged leaders at the highest levels, and publicly elevated the threat to the UN Charter. The structural impediments, Mayant Yu acknowledges, were real. Decades of decline in the prestige of the Secretary General's office on peacemaking matters, and the absence of a supporting coalition of neutral states. On China, Mayant Yu's assessment is that Beijing consistently invokes the UN Charter and the UN system in its foreign policy, and, as a permanent Security Council member, has access to a ready-made international hierarchy. He assesses China is more likely to seek to work within and refurbish the existing UN system than to pursue a parallel institutional path, characterizing China as seeking dominant player status within the system rather than unilateral global rule. On Taiwan, Mayant Yu assessed that a Chinese move against the island would constitute a global crisis of the first order. The Security Council would almost certainly be deadlocked. The office of the Secretary General would be the relevant UN instrument for any response, and given his earlier analysis of that office's diminished capacity, that is a sobering structural observation. It also connects to a separately reported warning cited in the sourced material attributed to Elon Musk that almost all advanced AI chip fabrication facilities are located in Taiwan, and that a Chinese invasion would cut the world off from advanced AI chips. That intersection of military risk and technological dependency is not one that conventional security analysis has always centered, but it increasingly shapes the strategic calculus. Mayant Yu described the risk of a third world war involving nuclear weapons as not insignificant over the next couple of decades. That characterization gains additional weight when read alongside the 15 cooling generator failures at Zaporizhia and alongside British and Estonian intelligence assessments cited in the sourced reporting that Putin may attempt to expand the war toward NATO member states, with the Baltic states identified as a possible target. Finally, a note on North American trade architecture, sourced from commentary describing signals between Washington and Ottawa in the period surrounding a Toronto summit in May 2026. According to this single-source commentary, and that caveat matters, Washington signaled its willingness to revisit bilateral arrangements previously treated as settled. These include cross-border energy infrastructure, pipelines, transmission lines, and interconnected grid systems. Also, Great Lakes water-sharing agreements, governed by the 2012 Great Lakes Compact, and joint technology partnerships, including defense-adjacent research collaborations, under the Defense Production Sharing Agreement. These signals, per the cited source, were delivered through back channels, briefings, and deliberate leaks rather than formal announcements. The proximate pressure point is the July 1st CUSMA review deadline, the Canada-United States-Mexico agreement that governs North American trade. A full collapse of CUSMA would, per the sourced commentary, remove tariff exemptions from over 90% of Canadian exports. The most likely outcome described is CUSMA entering annual review rather than receiving a confirmed 16-year extension, a deliberate withholding of certainty rather than a formal breakdown. The sourced commentary also notes that the average American household is already paying approximately $1,500 more annually as a result of tariff pressures, though this figure is not independently attributed within the transcript. The sourced commentary also describes a gathering identified as the Global Progress Action Summit held in Toronto in May 2026, at which Barack Obama is cited as a speaker and Canadian cabinet members are described as present. No statements from Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney or any U.S. government spokesperson are included in the source material, and the single-source nature of this section warrants a degree of analytical caution. To bring today's briefing together, what we're seeing across these stories is a set of interlocking pressures that are reshaping the war's trajectory and the broader international order simultaneously. Ukraine has moved beyond reactive defense into a systematic campaign targeting the economic infrastructure of Russian war-making capacity. Russia's economic and manpower indicators are deteriorating, with a Kremlin-linked institution itself warning of cascading defaults. Sweden's commitment of Gripen aircraft represents a meaningful long-term augmentation of Ukrainian air power, while the ballistic missile defense gap remains unresolved and diplomatically urgent. And, at the institutional level, the UN's diminished capacity for interstate mediation means there is no obvious multilateral mechanism to manage the escalation risks that multiple sources in today's briefing describe as not insignificant. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for today from Briefing Desk. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest developments across international affairs.